Chapter 2 Wu Wei. We would like to focus on the following words taken from the quotation opposite. That is why the sage engages in not doing. He carries out the teachings without words. The second chapter of this archaic Chinese gospel builds on the foundations laid in the first and reveals even more clearly the essence underlying the world of antitheses, or what we call the dialectical nature order. It shows that all entities belonging to this nature order help to maintain it by obeying and feeding the law of antitheses in everything they do. Lao Tzu shows that everything in this nature order is a delusion, unreal in relation to the essential, the absolute, the divine. No doubt it could be said that dialectics possesses a certain kind of reality, but it is a reality which can in no way be compared with the absolute, the original. Lao Tzu explains that since, in this world, everything is subject to the law of antitheses and hence to change, it is senseless to cling to the phenomena arising from it, because they are transitory. But in this world of fundamental unreality, people refuse to accept its laws, and they try to make it into something real, despite their invariable experience that whatever they have tried to do always turns into its opposite. Everyone has a certain concept of what constitutes beauty, for instance. Yet our impressions of beauty, the things we consider to be beautiful, differ widely. They are not only influenced by the period in which one lives, by nationality and race, customs and manners, education and culture, but above all, they are extremely personal. In addition, our views on what is beautiful are often influenced by authorities, such as teachers, parents, and artists. And that is why fierce quarrels can arise when one person expresses dislike for what another person finds beautiful. But whether a thing is truly beautiful, no one knows. That is how it can happen, that you become attached to certain things you find beautiful, even to the extent, as it were, that you luxuriate in them every day, just because you enjoy them so much. And you would be most disappointed and even shocked if someone were to say to you, possibly in all innocence, "I don't like that at all. How could you?" Possibly, you would feel injured to the depths of your soul. Why? Because you feel intuitively that beauty in this dialectical nature is only a semblance. You do not know the reality of beauty with which your impressions of it could be compared. You might be inclined to see beauty in nature, in a forest, for instance. But if you look more closely, it is no exaggeration to say that you will find much to be desired. You see some scenery and exclaim enthusiastically, "Oh, how beautiful!" But when you come closer and observe it objectively, you are bound to see ugliness in it as well, sometimes even to such an extent that you turn away in disappointment. Traveling through the mountains, one sometimes comes across a beautiful valley whose colors and form fill one with wonder. Edgar Allan Poe once wrote about such a valley in one of his stories, in his own inimitable and penetrating way. The visitors to the valley, when they went down into the village, found that literally everything in it was in conflict with beauty and harmony. They then had to submit to the harsh reality of ugliness. As regards true beauty, humankind is utterly destitute, and that is why he is so attached to illusion. Because of his miserable condition, he tries to lie ugliness out of existence. But that doesn't work, because if one builds one's life on delusion, on what is unreal, one provokes counter-reactions. If you discover that something is wrong with a particular situation, a situation you were formerly convinced was wonderful, you will probably be unwilling to accept your discovery at first. But the further you continue, the more the reality of the ugliness impresses itself upon you, and you see that you have been engrossed in a degeneration caused by delusion. Both the delusion of beauty and the delusion of goodness bring ugliness to the surface. Now you may be thinking, If goodness and beauty in our nature are delusions, then surely you must say the same about badness and ugliness. Badness and ugliness must be delusions too. If we carry that proposition to its logical conclusion, then we could call ugliness beautiful and evil good. But that would be a mistake, a fallacy. There are people who hold such convictions, and there are various groups, such as the Christian Scientists, who try to deny the reality of ugliness, imperfection, illness, and pain. They say, all this misery and ugliness is not real. If only you hold on firmly to that thought, it will turn into its opposite, and you will recover. But they also develop illnesses to which they succumb sooner or later. If we try to lie ugliness out of existence, we provoke unpleasant reactions, for beauty and ugliness, good and bad, are not equivalent. If we say that beauty is a delusion, one may not simply draw the conclusion that ugliness is a delusion as well. No, ugliness is proof of the delusion of beauty. If you are attached to a delusion, ugliness will appear to reveal to you the fact that you were deluded. Ugliness is the proof that beauty is not beautiful, just as evil is the proof that goodness is not good. So beauty and goodness as the ego sees them are lies. The appearance of ugliness and evil proves this to us. So it could be said that ugliness and evil are essential in this nature order, an inevitable part of this nature order. In essence, this world is characterized by the most wretched misery. Perhaps you don't agree with us about this, perhaps you haven't become conscious of it yet, but as you continue on your path through life, you are bound to see the truth of what we are saying in the end. The beauty and goodness of this nature are lies. If this were not the case, beauty would bring forth beauty, and goodness would bring forth goodness. If you possessed anything genuinely good, do you think it could turn into bad or ugliness? Quite impossible. What you believe to be beauty is a delusion, and that is why it always brings ugliness to the surface. There is one more question you might think of asking. If we were to combat ugliness and evil in this world, would we not be able to turn them into good? Could we not raise this society, this world, this order of existence into the light? Humankind has made countless attempts to do this, but look at the results, and you will see how, throughout the ages, they have always been negative. No, if you really want a solution, you will first need to relinquish all aspects of your delusion. When we put it like that, you may think what we are telling you is quite ordinary and say without hesitation, yes, of course, that is the solution. People are always trying to camouflage ugliness and evil, the essential aspects of our nature order, in a cloak of delusion, so let us do away with all that pretense. But when you have done that, when you have neutralized all the delusion in your everyday life, what will you have left? Nothing except ugliness, loneliness, desolation, drabness, absolute, monotonous ugliness. Look around you, and you will see how people all over the world are jettisoning delusion. And what comes in its place? One great horror of dehumanization and brutality. Right there, at that point, is where Lao Tzu has driven us into a corner. Many people are striving to overcome delusion in their lives, but inevitably, what they are left with is ugliness, unspeakable ugliness. So if you find yourself in that corner into which we are driven by the ancient Chinese Bible, if you have seen through all that delusion and outward show, and have experienced the bleak misery and hopelessness of this nature order, and recognized it for what it is, then only one solution will be open to you, that you detach yourself from this dualistic nature, that you turn away from this world of delusion and follow the path of transfiguristic revolution, the path of return to the house of the Father. Then, like the prodigal son, you will know that here you are among the swine eating pig's will, and only one solution will remain. to rise up from this life of delusion and say in life-renewing action, I shall return to the Father, to the Father's house, to the original fatherland. This revolution must naturally have a beginning, a method that one uses at the start of the process. And this is what we would like to describe, aided by Lao Tzu's text. Lao Tzu called this method not doing, or Wu Wei. We have talked about this before in the school, but at that time, the majority of pupils did not understand what we meant. It is possible to describe this method intellectually. But what use would that be? How could that liberate you? So we would like to try once more to give you some understanding of the doctrine of not doing and to anchor it in your soul. We would like to try to deepen your understanding of Wu Wei because the wise soul must engage in not doing. Let us put it this way. You enter the school of the Golden Rosy Cross as a beginning pupil, and inevitably you are filled with enthusiasm and joy and the best of intentions. And because of your enthusiasm, you fling yourself with great energy into the teachings and into the life that the school seeks to reveal to you. But the behavior resulting from this sparkling enthusiasm and dynamism, which we observe in almost every new pupil, is not at all in keeping with the liberating method of not doing. Because by this typically dialectical behavior, you invoke the law of antitheses, you set it in motion. You find the school beautiful, you find it good, and you surround it in a golden glow. But in the world of dialectics, the beautiful and the good invariably bring forth ugliness and evil, thereby proving the delusion and unreality of what was perceived as beauty. If you are an older pupil who has perhaps been in the school for many years, may we ask you whether there are not times when all the things you thought to be beautiful seem dreary and ugly, so that you say disconsolately, I have been doing my best for so many years, and what do I have to show for it? And you are flung back to your starting point, back to the loneliness, the ugliness, the drabness. As a reaction to this, the thought often arises that something is wrong with the school, yet that is not the right reaction, because it is the law of antitheses that makes beauty turn into ugliness. So your enthusiastic behavior, the dynamic way in which you threw yourself into the work of the school, turns out not to have been a reality in the divine sense. In a way, your enthusiasm was a purely dialectical reaction, a reaction of your nature-born ego. That is why the time always comes when your joy reverts to disappointment, sorrow, loneliness, and weariness, and you fall into habits, into a condition of crystallization. Then a new impulse is often necessary to make you enthusiastic and joyful, very often with the same result. In this way, a kind of psychological cramp arises, full of ups and downs, and on you go. When you think about all this, you will perhaps be bewildered and ask yourself, or ask us, am I not supposed to be joyful then? Am I not meant to be enthusiastic about having found the school? May I not be pleased and grateful that I see the path of liberation before me? If this mercy and the joy I feel because of it give rise to such a downfall, what in heaven's name must I do? Well, no one, and least of all the Brotherhood of Salvation, wants to take that joy away from you, but we do need to advise you to change your psychological reactions to that joy in a fundamental way. Just think for a while about what people do when they are filled with feelings of joy and gratitude. In their enthusiasm, they feel like embracing everyone, and everything seems good and beautiful to them. They want to rush headlong into the liberating life, but that is a misguided and unintelligent reaction. Instead, when what is holy enters your life, there should be what the Bible calls a tranquil joy, an experiencing of the doctrine without words. Not doing does not mean simply withdrawing from dialectics, as you may have thought. It does not mean just distancing yourself from ordinary life, so that you are not drawn into it anymore. If your pupilship is genuine, you will do these things quite spontaneously. If you have recognized the ugliness, the emptiness, the delusion of dialectics, if you have tasted the nature of death in its deepest essence, then you will surely take leave of it as a matter of course. Know the not doing of Lao Tzu means that you do not grasp at the values, the forces, the essence of the immovable kingdom with your ego. Do not do that, is what is being said to you. Do not touch. If you lay hold of the things of the immovable kingdom with your hands, if you pounce on them with your eye, you will be thrown back. Flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. The urge to possess is part of human nature, but the things of the immovable kingdom cannot be grasped with one's fingers. Do not do that. It is simply not possible to possess the divine on the basis of one's natural state, so any attempt to do so is bound to end in trouble and disappointment. It may also be accompanied by illness, overexcitement, nervous disorders, disturbances of the endocrine system, and overshadowing. The new life comes neither into the eye, nor for the eye, nor through the eye of this nature. With the eye, only mysticism and occultism are possible. There are parts of the reflection sphere, the realm of the dead, in which various occult brotherhoods maintain themselves in a domain of delusion which they have created. One can certainly make a link with domains like these, but that will only mean one has been taken in by a delusion from which one will someday have to fall, having sustained serious damage. In view of all this, even a child could understand that if a person yearns for genuine liberation from the nature of death, his ego must engage in not doing and must stop trying to grasp the new life, the universal brotherhood, and everything related to it in any way. That is what you must not do, so do not concentrate, do not meditate, and above all, do not fantasize. Keep to absolute not doing. The method of not doing is a still, tranquil joy. One goes forward in that joy in total self-surrender to the kingdom within you, the primordial atom. That is what is meant by engaging in not doing. That is what is meant by experiencing the doctrine without words. Not I, but he, the other one, who is more than I, must increase. And I must perish, I must sink into the other one, into that other being, contained within the primordial atom. When a worker in the spiritual school is given a task, he is undertaking the most difficult work of all. He will have to walk on a path as narrow as a razor's edge, for the worker will not be able to carry out his task as an I being. If he tries to do so, he will plummet like a meteor. No one else makes him do that. He is not expelled from the school, as is sometimes believed. No, he does it to himself. For the worker who wishes to serve, only one way is open, the way of not doing. He serves in a state of tranquil joy, safeguarding the task in the heart and in an attitude of profound modesty and absolute devotion to the mystery of the primordial atom. For it is from the temple of the primordial atom that the work must be fulfilled, after the manner of all great heralds of the universal doctrine, past and present, who did what they had to do and then vanished as if into the mist. That is why the pupil who is fulfilling the work in his own being in the service of others will not be attached to that work. He will not cling to it with his ego. Under no circumstances will the ego push itself forward. Attempts to push oneself to the forefront in the work, or to carry it out from the standpoint of one's ego, are evidence of the most pronounced egocentricity imaginable. Such attempts mean that one is misusing Jesus Christ to bring oneself to the top of the wall or over it. Clearly, grace will depart from such persons. It has no option but to flee. That is why the sage engages in not doing. He carries out the teachings without words. That is the mystery of salvation. Precisely because he is not attached to it, it will not leave him. If you follow the path in self-surrender as a silent observer, you will discover that even though, inwardly, you always remain detached, the new life will shine over you. The new life is not of you but of the other one, in whom your own dialectical self melts entirely away. And that is the meaning of not doing. That is the way, the path. That is Tao.